Welcome back to the Soundtracker Podcast. I'm your host, Eric Peacock. So today it's Natural Born Killers Part 2, or Side B. And once again, obviously, I'm joined by Scott Wampler of the KingCast to finish up the talk on the movie and the soundtrack, which is, you know, what we're all here for. Once again, I want to remind everyone that the Patreon is currently free for 30 days. You get a free 30-day trial. There's no catch. If you don't like it, cancel it at the end of the month. But I cannot stress enough that we are at a very crucial point with this show. The most crucial time that this show's ever had where, you know, I know that free trial doesn't help me at all, but if you check it out and you keep it, obviously that does. And if you've been thinking about it, this is the time. Please check it out. It's going to determine the next few months of this show and whether anything goes beyond that. So I'm imploring you to check that out if you like this show. Like I said, you can sign up for free. And, you know, if you don't like it, cancel it after 30 days. As far as what I've got coming up, so after this, in February, I have Valley Girl, The Long Kiss Goodnight, and Carlito's Way will be on the main episodes. The bonus episodes will be Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas and Airheads. So again, if you sign up, you can listen to those for free this month. And if you don't like it at the end of the month, you can cancel. I just put up Young Guns 2 and Who's the Man, and I've got 14 other episodes on top of that. So I can't think of a better bargain than free for 30 days. And, you know, check it out, see what you think. But it is, this show might not go much longer, and I need people to check it out because there's just, again, things in my life that are really making this show hard to do. And, you know, that is what's going to keep it going. So it's free. Check it out. www.patreon.com/soundtracker. I know I'm beating that drum a lot, but it is so important. All right, here it is. Natural Born Killers Part 2. Enjoy.
Ain't no use running, ain't nowhere to hide. The beast is coming and he's got you in his sights. He ain't gonna miss you and he ain't gonna mess around. If you're a movie with original song, the soundtrack, I'm gonna track you down! Oh, yeah!
I love how viscerally violent the prison riot is. Mm-hmm. Like it is just like people getting eviscerated.
It's an orgy of violence, yeah.
Yes, 100%. And I like to, Mickey, when they're in the cell safe, you know, like away from everything, and Mickey figuratively disarms everyone with a joke. And then literally when he takes that shotgun away and kills most of the guards,
yeah,
and, like, you know, it goes from one to the other. But he takes Wayne with him. And in the other, meanwhile, Scagnetti's trying to fuck Mallory, who beats the shit out of him. And only one of the guards come in and help him. He goes hog wild with that mace. But there's that standoff in Mallory's cell with Mickey and Scagnetti. And I do love how that all plays out, too, where he's like, you want Mallory to be the one to get him. You know what I mean? Like, at that point, you want Mallory to be the one who gets Scagnetti.
Right.
And it almost looks like it might not play out that way. Like, it's like a, you know, they got kind of like, it's just a standoff. You know, he's got his shotgun leveled on Scagnetti. Scagnetti's got him. And she comes up and slits his throat. Mickey and Mallory reunite. And they're trying to get it on camera. And in the background... In the background, Scagnetti's like gurgling.
Yeah.
Gail tells him to shut the fuck up while he's back there dying is so fucking funny. Like, you're ruining great television right now by gurgling on your own blood behind us as you die. Shut the fuck up. It's an undignified death for Scagnetti. But I love to, like, McCluskey does not handle the riot well. He's just looking terrified. And another extremely funny bit in this movie is when one of the other guards comes in and starts telling McCluskey, like giving him the score, like everything that's happened so far. And he's like, his whole face is just like this grimace. You know what I mean? Like, he's just like wide eyed. His mouth is agape. And then he tells him Scagnetti died. And he kind of gives this really quick, like, whatever kind of look for yeah. 1 second that is just so fucking
like
funny.
That's an acceptable loss.
But yeah, Gail starts killing the guards. Okay, so maybe you said you watched this a couple months ago. Maybe I missed something in this and I didn't want to rewind last night, but that other prisoner shows up and he's like, hi, I'm Owen. And you've kind of like seen him in the background the whole time, but he wants them to take him with them. And
right.
What happens to him? Because I know they say, well, they killed the other guard they took hostage.
This is, you know, that's a lead into the alternate ending. And the alternate ending is they get out of the prison and like Owen's driving a van, if I remember correctly, and Mickey and Mallory are in it. And he ends up killing both of them.
Oh, see, I don't know that the
director's cut ending ends with Owen like killing and Mickey and Mallory. Very, you know, kind of indifferently, or you know, you realize there's an even worse monster out there, you know, okay. is kind of the message I got from that. And that in breaking out of prison, they have now unleashed this guy onto the world.
Okay. See, and I didn't know that about the alternate ending. Cause the director's cut ending is the normal ending. And the alternate ending is like a deleted, it exists as what is a deleted scene, I'm assuming.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah.
Okay. Because I've never seen that. Yeah.
Alternate ending in the sense that, you know, it wasn't used.
Okay. Yeah. All right. So, you know, it ends with this big riot. McCluskey gets literally torn apart by prisoners, which that's the one part that I know is different between the director's cut and the theatrical, because in the theatrical, he just gets pulled down into the crowd and you kind of hear him screaming. But in the director's cut, they raise like his arms and his head and, not a great death for McCluskey. But yeah, so it ends with Wayne gives them one more interview and, you know, he says it's his turn and instead they kill him. And I love how he handles it too. He's like, I think they're both kind of like, we kind of like you actually, but we have to do this. Like you have to right. Has to happen this way. And like, he just kind of like, at first he's terrified. He tries to run off and then he just kind of accepts it. I love his, ooh, he's like waiting for them to shoot him. It's so funny, but they leave the camera as the one remaining witness. And, the movie ends with a montage of media circus trials and we go to credits and that's Natural Born Killers.
God, I want to watch it again right now. It's so fucking, I love this movie so goddamn much. Yeah, I'm just kind of lost in thought on that. It's really a piece of work, you know. I don't know what to say. We've gone through the whole goddamn thing, like scene by scene. but it's just thinking about it makes me want to watch it. I don't know. Say something, please. Save me from running at like stopping mid-sentence. No.
I mean, now we get to move on to the soundtrack. So, you know, we get as far as the movie goes, okay. So I guess if I were to summarize Natural Born Killers, I think it's a fantastic, I have loved this movie since it first came out. I think it's a really great, entertaining movie that like, I think if it were even a few degrees more grim than it is, it might not work as well because it's so unsubtle with the commentary that it's trying to make. But I think the fact that everything is cranked up to 11, everyone's cranked up to 11, it makes that all work too. But at the same time, like I said, it also leads to certain people looking at this and saying that it missed the mark. I don't agree with that. Right. I just want to say that I do not agree with that, but I can see where people like that are coming from. You know what I mean? And I think it's just because this is such a fun movie to watch and it shouldn't be the way you describe a movie like this is it's fun to watch, but it is.
Yeah, I mean, this is going back to the, you know, 2 hours ago, the conversation we had about, you know, whether or not it undermines the point of the movie with the cartoonishness. I think the movie makes its point really, really, really well.
Yeah.
But I think it requires that you are media literate, that you can discern between fact and fiction, and that you understand, like, that everything in the movie is again of a piece, and that's really what we're talking about here right now. It's ferociously entertaining.
Mm-hmm.
There's all kinds of problematic or upsetting things in it. I won't go to bat for those, obviously. But I think it's an indictment of the media that was before its time. Mm-hmm. You know, as much of a success as it was, I think if you release this exact same movie now, it would be an even bigger hit.
Oh yeah. I mean, I 100% agree on that because of like the climate around journalism now, especially, and like the true crime thing and Shows like Dahmer. Yeah, I 100% agree that it would probably be a much bigger thing now.
Can you imagine? I mean, Oliver Stone would be in trouble. He doesn't give a fuck about being in trouble.
Right.
But it would be like the fucking, the discourse. Imagine 2023 Natural Born Killers discourse. How like insufferable that would be. How be like, terrible. Oh my Lord. I am. It's yeah, a fun thing. It's a fun thing to think about because like there was a period where I was just like sour a lot about discourse over this movie or that movie. And it was like, why are you saying that? Or like, this is stupid or whatever. And now I'm just like, I've gotten to the point with it where I kind of feel like this in and of itself is its own little mini industry within the industry of film coverage, where we are picking up old movies and then deciding that they are bad. You know, like a couple of years ago, famously, there was that fucking editorial that went around where some fucking 21-year-old watched The Shining for the first time and was like, guys, I don't think Jack Torrance is a very good guy. He seems a little bit abusive in The Shining. And you're like, are you out of your fucking mind? And I do not buy the explanation for these sorts of posts that's like, well, it's just for the clicks. The editor knows it's for the clicks, but these writers that are getting sucked up into like the online blogging community, they are being trained to do this shit, you know, and yeah. And are being made to look fools of in the process. People, you know, I wrote online, like I was an online film blogger, whatever horrible fucking, you know, fucking title you want to attach to it. It is not a position worthy of respect, in my opinion. But I'll hear from people sometimes that are like, what's your advice on getting into this or whatever? And I'm like, don't. There is no future here. Either you're going to get farmed out for these like utterly ridiculous articles where people will forever associate your name with a thing you were like goaded into by someone who was concerned about the traffic and doesn't give a fuck about the respectability of their site or, you know, integrity or any of those things that you should be concerned with. If you manage to get through that, you're going to get replaced by AI in the next few years. And yeah, that shit is absolutely coming. I won't name the site, but sometime within the last 5 years, I picked up a job, like a side gig with one of the top three, like film blogs. And my job, which was entirely behind the scenes, was editing some of the stuff that they were putting on the site. Right. Mm-hmm. And after editing X number of things, I eventually arrived at a post where I was like, listen, I don't care what y'all run, but like, why on earth are you running this? Like, this seems insane to me. I don't understand. And it's going to take me 3 hours to do this. And before I get started, I just like to know like what the thinking is here, because this seems insane to me. And what I was told was that the company that owned this site had an algorithm, and that the algorithm trolled Google search results to see what people were searching for. And then they determined what those search, like what those questions were, and then assigned them to writers, contributing writers. You know, and here I'm talking about kids that, and when I say kids, I'm talking about like early 20s. You know, they're out of college, maybe they're looking to make a few extra bucks on the side. They're interested in movies. But the idea was like, well, we assign these pitches to writers, or they can claim them, and then you know, as people search for this thing, they will find it on our site and it'll be a big hit. And I was like, so you're automating the process. This was so like antithetical to me, to after the work I had done on Birth, Movies, Death, where our guiding principle for all of our writers was write whatever you're passionate about today.
Yeah.
And that guaranteed that, you know, the writers were coming at it from an informed perspective. You know, if they weren't informed, they wouldn't be passionate about it. And so to assign something like that to someone and then kick it out there felt like not only throwing the writers under the bus, but also like automating this entire process. And it was so dark. But also I was like, well, it's a paycheck. I'll fucking edit this shit.
Yeah.
Like my name's not associated with this. I don't give a shit. You know, and eventually I quit that job, that like side gig. Part of it had to do with, you know, feeling not great about that. And the other part of it was just like, I got too busy with the show. But like, I do feel like we are on the cusp, and I've seen it. I know that some websites use AI to generate entire posts. I know that because like the other night I met up with a friend that I hadn't spoken to in a couple of years. And she had taken on a little gig editing posts for a very big site. And her whole job was to go through AI posts and just tweak the wording so it didn't sound like AI. And I was like, this is exactly what I feared. This is a dying industry.
Yeah.
You should not get into it. You know, if you have a voice, you know, and something that will compel people, like you've got to, you basically got to go out on your own, because mm-hmm. the sites that are left standing after the bloodbath of the last 10 years, where every good movie website has been basically wiped out and replaced with like an entirely corporate entity.
Yeah. Listicles.
Yeah. You're fucked. This is scary shit.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm glad I'm not in that business anymore. There's no chance of me like having to reckon with that now.
Yeah.
But I look at it and I'm like, this fucking sucks, because there were a lot of websites I really enjoyed reading that have really fallen off. And what are we going to be fucking left with? I'm sorry. I've been talking for like 20 goddamn minutes.
No, it's fine. It's fine. You're right, though. I mean, like the AI thing. I don't like it. I don't like it. I'll summarize it by saying that I do
art
not like
writing none of that shit. No,
nope, no, because it's and like the people who don't understand why people don't like it drive me fucking nuts.
Because mm-hmm.
it's all tech people that are like, why wouldn't you like this? Why the fuck would I like this?
That's
why
true.
Would I like something that's like automating you? I don't know. Yeah, it sucks. It sucks.
You know, when I started out like in this business. I got really into collecting screen prints of movie posters, like Mondo does, or
mm-hmm.
Bottleneck Gallery, or you know, there's a million of them, right?
Yeah,
Mondo's sort of the queen mother of those things. But you know, I went through a period of about 3-4 years where I was at the time I was making a lot of money, and I was buying these things up like left and fucking right, you know, because some of them would end up being worth a lot of money. And I had a like a column that I wrote on Collider back in the day that was entirely about that. Like that was my job at a certain point, was I just wrote up about movie poster releases and this artist, that artist. Anyway, the end result of this is that I'm now friends with, or at least Twitter friendly with, like a number of different artists.
Yeah.
And so I see like both sides of the equation on that, where most of them are like, fuck this. Like we cannot do this. And other people are embracing it and seeing the upside to it and seeing it as a new tool in their arsenal. One of whom is Rob Sheridan, who's a really good friend of mine.
Oh, yeah.
He's the former art director for Nine Inch Nails, by the way, for like 15 years. Like he designed, you know, the classic Nine Inch Nails look. And here I'm talking about album covers, merchandise, like their shows, even like the live shows. You know, this man is a genius, and he has fully embraced it. You know, and he's using it to his advantage. He's finding the upside in all this and trying to stay ahead of it. I respect that.
Yeah.
At the same time, I also respect the artists that are like, I developed my fucking talent over X number of years, and I don't want this co-opted by some jerk off eighth grader who's like knows my name and can say like, you know, for instance, like Ollie Moss style, and it like plus and blah, 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 like whatever your search terms are in order to pull this off. You're not a fucking artist, you know?
Right.
I'm seeing that debate has me very conflicted about the entire thing, but mostly I'm like, nah, fuck this. I want warmth to my art. I want humanity in it. I don't want it being generated for me in the same way that I don't want written material for me to read, like on movie websites or other sites that I might be reading, generated by a fucking computer. I want a human being on the other end of that.
Yeah.
That's we're talking about natural-born killers, folks. We are way off the mark.
This is like we're reaching Dreamcatcher commentary territory.
Yeah, please get me back on track. I'm sorry.
No, I like this kind. There's all kinds of room for digressions and asides on this show. They happen every episode.
All right.
Okay. Well, let's talk the soundtrack then. We'll move it forward.
Good. Good. Please.
So the film soundtrack was produced by Oliver Stone and Trent Reznor of Nine Inch Nails, as we've said earlier. But according to Reznor, he watched the film over 50 times to get in the mood to make this. And he produced the soundtrack while he was on tour. His approach to compiling this soundtrack, and this is directly from him in an interview with MTV, I suggested to Oliver to try to turn the soundtrack into a collage of sound, kind of the way the movie used music. Make edits, add dialogue, and make it something interesting rather than a bunch of previously released music. So I took a finished movie, he recalled, and tried to make something that would be a cool souvenir from it. Mm-hmm. So that was his approach for this. Reportedly, Stone and Reznor wanted to include a track by Snoop Dogg on the soundtrack, but Warner Brothers wouldn't allow it because at the time, Snoop was actually on trial for murder at the time of production for this movie. So they didn't want to like have his name associated with something like this as he was on trial. The soundtrack released on August 23rd, 1994. It debuted at number 49, and it eventually peaked at number 19. It ended up going gold, so it did very well. The top 10 the week that it was released, and this might be the most peak 90s list I've had so far. It's a very peak 90s list. Number one is the Lion King soundtrack. Number two is the Forrest Gump soundtrack. I know Forrest Gump was...
You could not escape Gump at this period of time.
Number three was Stone Temple Pilots Purple. Number four was Green Day's Dookie. Number five was Ace of Base, The Sign.
I knew fucking Ace of Base was going to be in here somewhere.
Number six was The Counting Crows, August and Everything After. Number seven was Warren G's Regulate the G-Funk Era. Number eight was Candlebox's self-titled album. Oh, number nine was The Offspring Smash. And number 10 was Soundgarden's Super Unknown. So that is like, that is running the gamut. And it's missing... conspicuously absent from here is Hootie and the Blowfish's Cracked Rearview and Alanis Morissette's Jagged Little Pill. So that's the only thing that keeps us from being the ultimate 90s list, as if those had somehow crammed on here, but those were not on here.
I will accept Counting Crows in place of Hootie.
That's true. That's true. Yeah. So further down the chart, these are three albums that were not in the top 10, but in the top 200 that never cracked the top 10 by notable artists. This is again, just to show you how many albums you had to sell to make the, you know, to make the top 10 back when people actually bought albums. Number 14 was Public Enemy's Music and Our Message, which peaked at number 14 as well. Debuted and peaked there. Number 25 was Aaliyah's Age Ain't Nothing But a Number, which only peaked at number 18. And number 86 was this one really surprised me, the Dazed and Confused soundtrack, which only peaked at number 70. I figured that would have been a much bigger seller.
Yeah, that's very surprising.
Right, because that's like a four times platinum soundtrack or some shit. You know what I mean? Like it actually sold better than did.
What's the difference between gold and platinum? Like what are the numbers?
500,000 albums is gold, 1 million albums is platinum.
Wow. So this doubled NBK's
No, it way more than doubled. It sold like eight times more than this did.
Oh, how many platinum?
It went like Dazed and Confused went like four times platinum, if I remember correctly.
That's fucking crazy. Although I guess that makes sense.
Well, I think
this
what it
is
comes
such
down
a
to
unique, weird soundtrack with like, you know, there's metal on here, there's rap. I imagine that being more of a bitter pill to swallow than say the other soundtrack, which is, you know, pretty classic square rock all the way through. Yeah.
And I think the other thing too with Dazed and Confused is one of those movies that like really found an audience in the years following its release and like continues to pick up kids that watch it. So like, you know, it's like an entry point for people. So I'm sure that like those albums have been spread out over a fucking 30 year period. You know what I'm saying? Like,
right.
It probably sells a decent number of albums every year. Even now, probably when people don't buy albums, I bet it sells on like iTunes or something.
Sure.
Or whatever the kids use nowadays to purchase albums. So technically everything on this soundtrack is a soundtrack original since they're edits for the soundtrack, but I'm not going to count it that way. As always, unless I say that it came off of this album, this is a soundtrack original. But if you've never heard this album, it all sort of bleeds into one another from track to track using samples from the movie. And it's a cool touch. It's a cool thing that he did by like bleeding one song into another, because the songs on this are so varying and like the genre and like sound, like it's a good way to tie this together, considering there's not like a real through line as far as like the genres of music present here. There's all kinds of shit on here. And we lead off with Leonard Cohen's Waiting for the Miracle, which is from his album The Future. This song was actually inspired by his then fiance and producer of that album, Rebecca De Mornay. No joke.
I had no idea Cohen was smashing Rebecca De Mornay.
Yeah, which is kind of fucked up, because in this song, the guy's apologizing to his lover for not being as into her as she is into him. And it's kind of like a guy waiting around to find something better. But yeah, this is inspired by her. But as you know, as far as the sound, like this is pure Leonard Cohen. Like it's dusty, it's smoky, it's sort of drab and dreary, but never becomes like him and Nick Cave have a market on like drab and dreary, but it never becomes overbearing to the point where it just feels like a slog. You know what I mean? Like they're great songs.
Leonard Cohen, I kind of put him in the same classification of Tom Waits, where it's like, if you're not familiar with these artists, you might listen to some of their songs and it's kind of a chore. But if you know the artists, it sounds like if Whiskey could sing. And it's sexy.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, you know, and I think Waiting for the Miracle is a sexy song, as depressing as it might be about, you know, his relationship with the hand that rocks the cradle.
I didn't know that either until I was putting these notes together. I had no idea that he was engaged to Rebecca.
Yeah, that's crazy.
And that she produced an album. Like, she's a multi-talented woman.
Holy shit.
But yeah, no, I love this song. I really like Leonard Cohen a lot.
Yeah.
This is a good song. It's weird that he chose From the Future, which is like, that was his follow-up to Waiting for the Man, which is like his big commercial breakthrough. I think at the time that it came out, it wasn't as loved as like, it's like all of his stuff, it's grown in stature over the years. But if I remember correctly, I think this was looked at as a disappointment at the time it came out. And they were not far removed, because that album came out in 92. Well, so it wasn't like,
oh, okay. Well, that clarifies it. So this song, I didn't know that. This song came out just a few years before this movie came out?
Yes.
I thought it was a much older song.
No.
See, I think I'm about to learn some shit.
that's why I'm here.
No, it's why I'm excited to be here.
Well, we follow that up.
That's like, oh, MacGruber, you and your dick jokes.
That's why I tell them. That's why I like hearing them.
And that's why I listen.
I shouldn't have fucked that quote up. I just did that movie like a month ago.
On the whole bit, fucking ruined. Everyone just tuned out. Everyone just closed up the tab and said no.
My brain on a weekly basis has to filter out old information for new information, and it's like useless shit from movies. Yeah. I had to let go of that particular quote so I could tell you that Rebecca De Mornay and Leonard Cohen were smashing at one time. Like that was replaced by that information.
I love
it. Next week, I'll forget that.
Yes.
Okay. So up next, we've got L7 Shitlist from the album Bricks Are Heavy. L7. I love L7. I love L7. They're a fucking fantastic. Their first couple albums are just fucking phenomenal. And this is such a good fuck you song. And like, what I like about this is like a general fuck you, not like a we just broke up and fuck you song like you get sometimes. Like, it's just,
it's just about
like
annoying motherfuckers.
Right. It's a song about people that piss her off. I love it.
We just recorded like the episode of our podcast that's dropping like in 2 days, which will be, you know, maybe a week or more after this drops, is an episode on Pet Sematary 2. Roxanne Benjamin is the guest. But I had to rewatch that movie in anticipation of that episode, and like mid movie, they drop shit list. And I was like, holy fucking shit. And I think I say on that episode, I was like, I have always associated the song with Natural Born Killer. So it was like jarring for it to pop up here in a scene where Clancy Brown is skinning rabbits. It's fucking wild, dude.
Pet Sematary 2 is a wild movie. I kind of have a big soft spot for Pet Sematary 2.
Yeah, I like it. I like it. I admire its balls.
Liked it. Clancy Brown is just having a time of his life in that movie as well.
Oh, like he's the reason to see Pet Sematary 2.
And the really rad motorbike death.
Oh, and he rips the face off the kid from Big.
Yes.
With a motorcycle wheel.
And his scarf.
If you're listening to this, please go back and check the KingCast for the episode Roxanne Benjamin versus Pet Sematary 2. You can hear more about this.
Did you mention during the episode, did you say, holy shit, this is a Natural Born Killers. I'm about to do a show.
Oh, I didn't. I didn't mention your show.
I see how it is.
Well, for all I knew, we were recording this in 2 weeks.
But yeah, no. It's great. I love her warbly sort of vocals. The like that really extremely 90s, like aggro alt rock guitar. Like it's great. It's great.
It's like it sounds like the Breeders a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, all that fuzz on the guitar. Yeah.
So up next, we've got Dan Zane's Moon Over Green County. So this is like, there's a couple of these on here. It's like basically a score piece. And it's got the like, tell them Mickey and Mallory Knox did it stuff layered over the top. But Dan Zanes was the leader of the band Del Fuegos. And he's in this Grammy winning group called Dan Zanes and Friends now. But, you know, this is a cool little piece of music. It invokes like a dusty, hot desert sort of setting, which is fitting for a lot of the movie. It's cool.
Which where does it appear within the movie?
I believe it is actually in one of those sequences, like when they're like cruising through the desert.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, up next, then, we've got Patti Smith's Rock and Roll. It's all I'm going to call it. The Flood remix. This is a mix originally.
Andy Levy's favorite song.
Andy Levy was supposed to be on this with us. He's got COVID for the second time in 3 weeks. Andy, I hope that you're better by the time this comes out. But
LOL owned. We have to say that.
I was so ready for him to be on here so I could make this whole bit about how he was begging me before the show to be the one to say the song title on the air. And he's not here to do it. So that sucks. I was so ready for that. But
The N-word is in the title of the song.
Right.
For anyone who don't know, and confused.
So here's the thing. Obviously, with this title, this song was controversial. It's always been controversial. Even in 1978, the song was controversial. And in October 2022, this was actually removed from all streaming services without comment. But the cover versions were not removed, which is weird. So there's like a bunch of covers, including Marilyn Manson, who's no stranger to using that word because he uses an irresponsible hate anthem. But it was obviously this song didn't get any mainstream radio play. It was never released as a single, but it's always been popular with live audiences. Patti Smith has had some interesting defenses of this song. I like Patti, but none of this really sits right with me. And like her defenses of this are even worse. Like, okay. So in her defenses, she says that she identifies as that word.
Because
to her, it means honorable outsider. I don't know how I feel about that.
I think if you're a white person, you don't get to use that word in discussion.
That's exactly how I feel.
Yeah. Like it's on the one hand, great song. On the other hand, you shouldn't be fucking singing it.
Right. And she's digging downward. Like, there's an interview with Rolling Stone where she just sounds so dense. Like the interviewer says, she says, anyone can identify with that particular word. And if anyone can identify with that particular word in this interview, it's Mick Jagger. And the interview like calls her out on it. Like that defines, like, what do you mean? That's bullshit. He's never suffered like anyone in Harlem is exactly what the interviewer says. And she says, to her, she defines that word as being an artist mutant that goes beyond gender. And then she goes on this long tirade about how she, what?
I said, no, I'm disagreeing. Oh,
you said hello.
Eddie.
I thought you said hello. Like my microphone went.
No. Like, I mean, go ahead, but I can imagine all the defenses it's terrible. Of this
Trust
song,
me.
But
this is terrible. No, this is not me saying that this is like not a defense of this at all. It's actually quite the opposite. Like I know,
but you love this song and you sing it all the time. you sing the lyrics to me straight up. Well, you don't even drop the end.
She says, she goes on a long tirade where she pulls the whole, like, I grew up around black people, and I pull one direct quote from it. She says, it's like, I can walk down the street and say to a kid, hey, that word, And she says, I don't have any kind of super respect or fear for that kind of stuff. When I say statements like that, they're not supposed to be analyzed because they're more like off the cuff, hilarious statements. I do have a sense of humor, you know, which is something that most people completely wash over when they deal with me. Basically, I'm giving all this background here because I'm not really sure how to talk about this song and I want to fill time. Like, I don't know what to say.
Well, I'll say this. I think that, you know, as controversial as the song might have been at the time, I think that people, like society, was more permissive of that back in the day. I was raised to believe you never say that word. And I don't. And I think that's just how it is. You know, so you can like justify this. And when I say you, I mean Patty. Like, you know, Patty can justify this like however she wants, but there's two things going on here. One is the time in which it was recorded and what our standards were then versus now. I don't think it's a bad song. I think it's a problematic song. And I think you have to look at it from the perspective of time and understand that, like, yeah, we don't do this anymore, but this did happen. You know, like, and I don't subscribe, like we were just talking about with The Shining and like whether or not Jack Torrance might be a bad guy. Like, you, our past fucking sucks, man.
Yeah.
Like, it's not good. And whatever she said at the time is not going to, it's not going to work today. There's just no justifying this.
Well, and the other thing is, like, I think this song is well-meaning. It's just done in a really boneheaded way. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
like, I wouldn't listen to this and be like, Patti Smith is like a huge bigot. I just think that she's a dumbass art person. You know what I mean? That's just that, like, I mean, like that whole statement she said about, like, I don't know, like Mick Jagger, like it's so pretentious. Yeah. And it's so,
or
like,
saying it to a kid. Imagine like fucking, what are you doing, Patti Smith, out on the street? Like, hey, blank. You want a candy cane or some candy? Or like, you know, I'll take you to a movie. Like,
no, the fuck they wouldn't.
You might be being very friendly, but like, why are you saying this word? this is a time difference thing.
Yeah.
You should ever do that now, you know,
but
it's a time capsule.
And the thing is, like, to going beyond that, let's just talk, like, as far as the song itself goes, like, the guitar part's greater vocals. I mean, the song rocks. It's got this, like, raw, nervous energy. And, like, look, if her whole goal was to make people uncomfortable, like, she definitely succeeded. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, again, it's like, I'm not mad about it. I know what happened. But I know it's not what we do now. It's not something I've ever done, nor would I do. So, but I'm not immediately angry about things that happened before,
right?
You know, and I say that with privilege. Like, I know that, you know, how I feel about it is different how, you know, the average black person might feel about it. In fact, there was a day back when I was bartending. It was me and another lady and a third lady who were, we were all bartending together one night, and we threw on the Natural Born Killer soundtrack, not remembering this. And one of those ladies was a black person. And as soon as the song started, me and the other lady who was white scrambled to change it. And the black lady was like, no, fucking leave the song on. And I'm like, I'm not comfortable doing that. Like, this seems
right.
Like, maybe we shouldn't. She's like, I love that song though. And so it's like, it's one of those things where it's up to everyone, you know, but it's especially up to our black friends. And I would never, ever, you know, knowingly play this in front of an African-American person or, I don't know. This is a tricky topic, but
it is.
Basically,
it is.
I'm just going to condemn it and say, you know, we can't do this anymore. This is what happened in 1978, but it is a time capsule. That's my best response.
And, you know, you said, like, a rapper that I really like just covered this song and, like, gave a big shout out to Patti Smith for being great and stuff. So, like, you know, I guess it's just, like I said, if her goal was to make people uncomfortable, mission accomplished.
Yeah, she won.
You can hear from us discussing this.
Yeah, she won. I'm uncomfortable. Let's move on to the next song.
Yeah. All right. So after that, Cowboy Junkie, no more. And then that's the last, elephant in the room sort of thing we have here.
Yeah.
So Cowboy Junkie, Sweet Jane from the album Trinity Sessions, which is a Velvet Underground cover. So I do my thing when I do covers, where I do this whole, my cover song guidelines are, is it different enough to justify existing? So for this one, the answer is yeah, but not terribly. It's barely different enough. It's basically the exact same song without the release that the original one has on the chorus, and it's slightly more down tempo. Like it's more, this is like one tempo straight through. And then my follow-up question, if it is different enough to justify existing, is did they fuck it up? No, not at all. I don't think so. It's not nearly as good as the original, but I still like this cover.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to admit my ignorance here and say that I had no idea it was a cover.
So you're learning all kinds of things.
Yeah, I'm here to learn. I'm here to learn all the time. I'm a very stupid man. I think about this song. There's something about this song that reminds me of, it's another song, another artist that isn't on this soundtrack, but it, fuck, what is it? That's driving me. I'm going to remember after we recorded this, and it's so going to destroy my life from the ground up. But, I think it's a great song. And if it's a cover, maybe if you cover it, you just, you know, it's still a great song.
Like I said, my whole criteria with the cover is like, is it different enough to justify existing? Did they fuck it up? And no, they did not. Like, I think that this is I like the Cowboy Junkies in general. I think Cowboy Junkies are good.
Who's the original artist again?
Velvet Underground.
Yeah. I'm not really into Velvet Underground. There's a few songs I like. This is probably why I was unaware of this. But yeah, it's fine. I mean, I like this song. I love this cover of the song. You know, I love this entire album, but didn't know that. Fair enough.
I'll send you the original after we get done here.
Is it on YouTube? Because I can just look it up. Like a gentleman.
So that leads us to Bob Dylan's You Belong to Me. This was actually, so I thought this was a soundtrack original because it's not on one of his albums, but that's not totally true. He had recorded this for his album Good As I'd Been to You, which was a couple years earlier, but it got left off that final track list, and then it kind of floated around and ended up on this album. So this is actually a song that was written by a bunch of songwriters and just floated around for a bunch of years in the 50s, and it ended up getting initially recorded by Patti Page was the first one to cover it. But it's been covered over the years by Ella Fitzgerald, Dean Martin, Tori Amos covered it, Marshall Crenshaw, Rose McGowan sings this on the Planet Terror soundtrack. There's a whole bunch of covers of this.
Oh, cool.
Here's what I love about this version of this cover. Because a lot of people, the biggest hang up for Bob Dylan, for most people who don't like Bob Dylan, is his voice.
Yes.
And this is Dylan really leaning into the Dylan voice.
Yeah.
It almost sounds like a parody. It almost sounds like he's parodying the Bob Dylan voice.
But it's perfect.
But I like
for the
it. I like
movie.
The Bob Dylan voice.
Yeah. And yes. It's perfect for that scene, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's a good one. It's a good one.
Are you a Dylan guy?
Yeah, I like Bob Dylan.
I like Bob Dylan, but I've never been a Dylan guy. You know, like I enjoy hearing his songs, but like I don't think I've ever owned a Bob Dylan album.
Okay, I didn't know what your definition of Dylan guy was. Yeah, I'm definitely a Dylan guy then. He's got a few albums
all
I love.
Right on. He feels like an artist, like maybe I'll get into at some point. Like Tom Waits was like this, you know? Mm-hmm. And it took me dating a lady that was like huge into Waits for me to like really pay attention to it. And then I got really into it, you know?
Yeah.
I don't think I will come naturally to a Bob Dylan fanboy thing, but I'm open to it. Like I'm very curious about that guy. You know, what I know about him is fascinating, but, and I like the songs I've heard, but I've never bought a Dylan album.
So you do like this one then?
Oh yeah. Yeah. It's a great
song.
Okay.
See that if you can get through this Dylan song, you'll like any, like, I don't think you have.
No, I know, like 15 Dylan songs. Like I know what he sounds like. I'm fine with that. I just, I like something heavier usually.
Oh yeah.
You know? So I haven't really explored that.
Yeah. I mean, you like Saliva and bands like that. Like
Puddle of Mud. We're talking, you know,
the heavy shit,
Limp Bizkit, you know, we're going to the classics here now.
All right. So up next, we've got Duane Eddy's The Trembler.
Yes. I love this song.
Well, and this is, so it's kind of a funny choice for a Duane Eddy track, because Duane Eddy worked directly with Lou Hazelwood on a bunch of songs in the 50s and 60s. And this was taken from his lone album that he made in the 1980s. But also I get why, because again, this is an instrumental piece. It's short. It's like a score song. This feels like a spiritual cousin to Moons Over Green County. Like, it's dusty road trip music.
Sure.
And it's very good.
I'm not breaking balls here, but I have to assume that you weren't familiar with Duane Eddy before this, right?
No, I wasn't.
Okay. So it's funny, like, doing this show and like, I'm learning things, and I'm very excited. I'm at full mast right now. But also, there's like an element of like the guy, like the Tim Heidecker character. I think you should leave. He's like, Tom Eddie Tompkins. You don't know him? And it's like, I don't know. Why would I know? Like, I didn't know who Duane Eddy is, but I love this fucking track. So yes.
Well, there's a lot of stuff that I do know. Duane Eddy, I did not. Admittedly, I did not know anything about Duane Eddy going into this.
Well, we credit Uncle T with that.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, so up next, speaking of Uncle T, we've got Nine Inch Nails' Burn. So yes. This was the promo single for the soundtrack. And it later appeared on the 10th anniversary edition of Downward Spiral. So yeah, you had said earlier, the video has like Reznor performing in front of a projection screen with stock footage from Natural Born Killers behind him. I did not realize that it was like mostly the scenes of him as a child.
Yeah, that's correct. I don't know if it's mostly, but that's the narrative through line for that.
Okay.
For that video, you know, I think this is a world-class Nine Inch Nails track. Like, I'll put this up with the track they had on the Crow soundtrack.
Yeah.
And really my predominant memory of this is that when I was in high school, like this would have been freshman year, maybe sophomore, but like my teacher was like, we need you to your assignment is to find it, you know, a music track you like, and then explain what it's about. Like, that was the assignment. And so I did this one, and I failed because the teacher just hated the fucking track. You know, it was just like, you know, this is inappropriate. It's too heavy. Like, and I'm like, that's not what the fucking assignment was here. It was like what I like, you know?
Right.
Yeah. So fuck that, dude. But that's my predominant memory of this song and the soundtrack, which rules. And, you know, this, you mentioned, you touched on this earlier about like Woody Harrelson having like crazy in his eyes. Like, that's something Oliver Stone said. If I remember correctly, Woody Harrelson had an abusive father, you know, and this was, you know, like, you know, that was personal to him, obviously. Why, how could it not be? But like, you know, I think about that too in relation to the song. Also, do you want to hear a very quick story about what a badass Woody Harrelson is?
Yeah.
Okay. So, you know, my, ex-wife, she was a special education teacher. She worked with special ed students, and, one time she and I went to visit my parents, my dad and his new wife, because my parents got divorced. Anyway, we went down there and they were like, hey, we thought we would go out and visit this place like just outside of Houston, which is, I forget the name of it, but it was a essentially like a place where special needs people all lived and worked by like producing original artwork and shit. And there was a whole like campus for this. I had no idea this existed. My wife was like blown away by this because it was, you know, very all the money that was made for this, like went back into the school and went to the students and all that shit. And apparently Woody Harrelson had been a student there, like when he was very young, because he has like crippling dyslexia or something.
Mm-hmm.
And very quietly for many years after and continuing to this day, he has like given money to this place to stay in operation. I really wish I could remember the name of the joint, but it was cool as fuck, man. They had a great facility. There were like arts and crafts that had been handmade by the students that were like sometimes mind blowing, you know, in their artistry. I think that's a really cool thing about that guy. Like he ended up here. He went on to like superstardom, but he's still giving money to that facility and like keeping them alive and, you know, probably giving them more money than anyone else.
Right. For sure.
I thought that was really fucking cool.
Yeah, no, that's great. I love hearing stories like that about, cause I love Woody Harrelson.
I know. Right. He seems like an exceptionally good dude.
Yep. And when you hear stories like that, it's always like, cause you always hate to hear stories about people that you like. And it's like, they're like a complete monster or something. Like not even like going beyond like something that's like completely unforgivable, just like them being an asshole. You know what I mean? Right. Like it sucks to hear that shit.
Totally.
But yeah, I love Byrne. Reznor never phoned it in. You know what I mean? And you can see again, along with Lost Highway, which we had talked about in a prior episode. If you have not listened to that one, I also have that. If you're here listening to this, Scott and I did Lost Highway a long time ago, but as a score guy, you know, he never phoned things in. And like I did when he gets to that part where I'm going to burn the whole world. Yeah, it's just so good. It's so good. It's like total chaos by the end of the song. Yeah, I love it.
It sounds like the apocalypse happening. You know, yeah. When it hits that, you know, I'm going to burn this hole like on down. Like it's like it sounds like the end of the world. It's, yeah. Oh, fuck.
It's
what
great.
A track.
It's great. Hi, everyone. So I'm back with another Patreon pitch, but something's changed this time. So I've been saying since the start of the Patreon that this is basically what's going to help keep this show going. And for people who might be sitting on the fence, I have something exciting. Patreon picked me as part of a test group to try free trials. So if you're someone who's been debating whether or not to get signed up, go to www.patreon.com/soundtracker, where you'll find my $3 tier, my $6 tier, and my $8 tier. The $3 tier comes with a 14-day free trial, and the $6 and $8 tiers come with a 30-day free trial. There's no commitment, and if you don't like it at the end of the month, you can cancel. But in that time, you can check out the bonus episodes and get a feel for it and see what you think. And if it's something you enjoy, hey, welcome aboard. But give it a shot. www.patreon.com/soundtracker. I'm not sure how long I'm going to be able to offer this, but as of now, it is something that I can offer. And it's exciting, and I'm hoping that this gets more people to check out these bonus episodes because there's some truly great stuff in there and more to come. So that leads us into two sort of quieter tracks. We got two, and there's like eight of these on the album. Where it's, so the first one is Route 666, which is a sample of Robert Downey Jr. in the movie played over BB by Brian Burden, where he takes these like bits from the movie and then plays them over these, like where he like, and then there's certain ones where he mixes like two songs together, but they work here because a lot of soundtracks would do this shit at the time where they'd have short bits between songs with dialogue. And like, you'd usually skip them, but him layering in the music works. Cause like, it's so ominous. Like the music that he mixes in here makes this song so ominous, despite the fact that it's with the bear claw dialogue too playing in the background. It just sounds so ominous, but it's a real cool trick that he did with these. And then the next one is Totally Hot, which is more dialogue layered over Remy Ungala's Compendo Rojo. And same with this one. It sounds like, actually, that song sounds like a Talking Head song. And it's like the part where people are talking about how awesome Mickey and Mallory are. And before you ask, I did not know who Remy Ungala was before I did this. So, you know, that is another one that I found out while putting the notes together for this. But that's who he used in that particular one. But then we get back into more standard fare. We got Patsy Cline Back in Baby's Arms from the Patsy Cline Story. This is an album I spoke about before during the Departed episode. She has a song on the Departed soundtrack. But that album came out 3 months after she died in a plane crash. And, you know, as I said in that episode, Patsy Cline was fucking awesome. And like, you know, having artists that I've liked who have died over the years, there's just something weird. Like when you get an album that comes out after an artist has passed away, where you kind of feel like it's kind of like being kneecapped as a fan, you know, like it's just such a waste of talent. And Patsy Cline was awesome. Like, I love Patsy Cline. I love her voice. And this song's like sneakily catchy too. Like, it doesn't do any like earworm stuff. There's not like a big chorus, but it still like manages to like wedge its way into your brain. You know, it's great.
Yeah, I agree. It's a great track. It's a classic. I think she might have, I don't know, but I think she might have a track on the U-Turn soundtrack.
It's possible.
I didn't prepare for that, but it's amazing. You know, there's not much to add beyond that. It's a perfect song.
So that leads us next to Peter Gabriel with Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan. The song's Taboo. Ali Khan is a famous Pakistani musician. I've said before, boo me if you must, but I don't really love Peter Gabriel. I like some of his stuff, but some I don't, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Stuff I don't like, I really don't like. And this kind of falls somewhere in between, honestly. This is like one of his like few grayer or like middle songs for me. Like, it's fine. I like the back half a lot more once like the ominous sort of drums kick in, but this is mostly Al Khan show.
Yeah.
You know, it's mostly Al Khan doing it. And I like that aspect of it. It's just, this is one of those ones that I would describe as a song that I wouldn't skip listening to it, but it's not one that I'm going to seek out to listen to immediately.
Fair.
Listen to the album as a whole. I won't skip this one.
Yeah, fair. I agree.
So up next, we've got Sex is Violent, which contains dialogue. One of those other ones that contains dialogue over Jane's Addiction's Ted Just Admit It and Diamanda Galla's I Put a Spell on You. This to me is probably the weakest one of these on here. Like, it just goes on for too long. It's like 5 minutes. It doesn't need to be as long as it ended up being, as far as these ones where he takes dialogue from the film and makes it into like a sort of like a collage of sound.
Yeah. And I don't know, man. I don't really like Jane's Addiction.
Oh, like, interesting.
Like, I've heard, I love, you know, the big songs that they have, you know, like I'm Through with Sergio or whatever the fuck that song is. Great Jane song. Jane Says. Yeah. Been Caught Stealing. I love that. But beyond that, I think Perry Farrell is just kind of a nerd.
Actually, you know what? I don't know why I said really like I'm surprised, because I kind of feel the same way you do about Jane's Addiction. Like,
yeah.
I honestly kind of do.
It's another band. I've never bought any of their albums, but, you know, the highlights. Yeah, that's good. But I do like this track on this particular album and where it shows up. Okay,
see, interesting. For me, this one just went a little too long. By the way, you were right. Patti Smith is on the U-Turn soundtrack. I had to look it up. It's Your Cheating Heart is on that soundtrack.
Patsy Cline.
Or what did I say?
Patti Smith.
Yeah, Patsy Cline. Sorry.
Yeah, the title of the Patti Smith song might have had another word added to it.
Okay, so up next we've got AOS History Repeats Itself. So this is one of those soundtrack mysteries I've talked about before, is like, this is an artist that had one song on a soundtrack. What happened to them? That actually, I have information on this one. Someone tracked them down. So it was this group, Wilbrandt, Boulert, and Lovsky were credited for it. And somebody found Faye Lovsky and explained what happened was, so there was one guy, Kurt Claus Boulert, and they made a song together for a project. And he sent this instrumental and she sang and wrote the words. And so they kind of put this song together and it eventually became this thing. But one of the guys, Wilbrandt, took ownership of the song and got it onto the soundtrack. They sent a bunch of songs to Oliver Stone. He really liked this one. And so they had recorded an album, but one of the guys in the band decided he was going to make it his project, despite the fact he was just brought on board. And so like, they have an album that just never got released because no one was interested in the album afterwards, and then a bunch of inner turmoil caused them to break up. So that's how we're left with this song because I think this song's great. And that's how we get left with a song this strong by a band who never did anything else, at least anything that got released. But it plays into one of my main points with this particular show that I've done, is that we have albums like this. Like, this band made a whole album and put this song on a soundtrack that sold 500,000 fucking copies and then just vanished. But it's weird to me that in this era of like Bandcamp that people just haven't released that shit now. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like you can release it yourself.
Well, there's probably a demand issue there. Well, like it's still, a good like, track, but like, is anyone clamoring for this?
Well, somebody was clamoring enough that they searched out this whole story as to what the hell happened to the band. So
that's
there's
one
be
person,
people.
You know, I mean, like I can find you a freak for anything. You know what I mean? Like,
well, typically I'm used to not having any background information on these. Cause I've ran through so many of these doing.
Yeah.
This
it's
show
interesting.
Now,
like, cause I had no idea who that was, you know, but it's a great track, but you know,
yeah, this is actually one of my favorites. Like it has this new age vibe mixed with something you'd hear in like a Smokey Noir movie and like a bar scene. And I like that combination mm-hmm. of sounds mm-hmm. together, but yeah, I really like this one. So up next we've got Nine Inch Nails, Something I Could Never Have from Pretty Hate Machine. So, Reznor co-produced this one in London with John Fryer, and he kind of backed away from it at first. He didn't like this song. He thought it gave it too much of a dreamy quality, and, the reverb and the filtered piano, he wasn't a fan of at first, and then came back on it and ended up really loving it. It also features unused backing tracks by This Mortal Coil in the background, which is interesting. Mm-hmm. They were actually included by accident, but they felt they fit the track well and kept them in here. But I love this one. This is, I might be wrong about this, but this was like their first ballad, right? Like sort of ballad, Nine Inch Nails ballad.
I can't think of it before it.
Ballad might not be the right word, but you know, softer song.
Yeah, it's now ballad, I think, is right. It's in Nine Inch Nails, like chronology, like, this is probably their softest, most gentle song at that time. Yeah. This is Pretty Hate Machine, I believe. Mm-hmm. You know, and then you get Hurt and a couple of other songs on Downward Spiral. But it's this is another one where I feel like it's a Nine Inch Nails classic. Like if you go see them live, you run a really good chance of hearing them perform this. Kind of like how they always close with Head Like a Hole. I don't know, man. It's
I love this song.
It's excellent. You know, I don't even know what to say in the face of it.
Yeah, it's a fantastic song. Well, that leads us to Russell Means' "I Will Take You Home." I know what I want to say about this one. Like, I get why this is on here, and I'm glad it made it. But this is literally just cribbed straight from the movie. Like, it is like they cut a chunk of the movie out and put it in the soundtrack. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty much all this is. But I get why it's here. It didn't need to be here, but I understand why they put it on here. That leads us to the Hollywood Persuaders' "Drums a Go Go" from the album of the same name, which is a real left field choice here because this band had two albums in the 60s and nothing since, and both of those albums have remained relative unknown since they first came out. So I'm kind of curious as to how Reznor knew about this song, but
he's a music nerd.
Yeah. Well, that's true. And like basically the Persuaders were this guy named Paul Buff who had like built the studio in Cucamonga, which eventually became Frank Zappa's famous Studio Z, the studio that this was recorded in. But he basically was like a shyster who offered flat free rates to up and coming bands who needed cost effective recordings. But he was also a real shady businessman who made way more money than the bands that he let record with him based off of what they did. So, but I mean, the song's fine. It's fine.
Sure. I don't have anything to add to it.
Yeah. That's as strong as I feel about it.
Yeah.
So up next, we've got Hungry Ants. It contains samples of the movie over Barry Adamson's Checkpoint Charlie and Violation of Expectation. This is another one of the ones that I think is a little overlong, but I like this one a lot better because the song itself kind of sounds like the Nightmare on Elm Street theme. Like that's what it reminds me of.
Yeah.
It sounds like that. And it fits on here. So it's fine. Again, I don't know what exactly to say about these ones where it's like a mixture of dialogue and sounds. Like they're fine. They're all good.
This is a weird album to do on this show because there's so much mishmash shit going on,
right?
You know, and some of the tracks are so short. It's like, you know, Drums a Go Go I think is what, like a minute long or something.
Well, and the other thing is I would normally skip over these under normal circumstances. I would skip tracks like this, but since he mixed other sounds in with this, I kind of have to talk about them since he kind of incorporated music and made them a musical piece as opposed to just being dialogue from the film.
Yeah, it's all smeared together, you know, like way back in the day. when I lived in Dallas, there was a place called Bill's Records and Tapes, which was like, you know, notorious for being like the record and tape shop to go to, like, in Dallas. And they had like tons of bootleg shit in that joint.
Yeah. Right?
And I remember going down there to collect these albums called Rusty Nails, which were like mega mixes of Nine Inch Nails songs where each one bled into another. And I kind of wonder, in relation to the Natural Born Killer soundtrack, if like Reznor hadn't heard some of these and was sort of responding to that in his own way. Like these constant mixes where like everything bleeds into, like each track bleeds into the next and whatever. But yeah, this is a difficult one to like look at the individual tracks and have too much to say beyond like, yeah, it's a great song. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, because some of them are so short and they're interstitials, basically.
Right, right. No, I agree. And this was a funny one to jump back into after not having done any of this for like a month. You know what I mean? Like,
oh, yeah.
I'm jumping into hard mode. You know
it's
what
like
I mean?
A schizophrenic soundtrack.
Yeah, but I'm breaking myself in for the new season.
Yeah, really well nice. Nice.
It's not going to get worse than, not going
to
get
I will always be here to smash that cherry. Baby.
Well, that leads us to Dr. Dre's The Day. We're just going to call it on this, you know, once again. This one, there's no elephant in the room with this one so much though, because there's no like controversy behind this one.
Sure.
So this was taken from The Chronic. This was one of my favorites on that album back when the album came out. I like this one because it's way more NWA than G-Funk. You know what I mean? Like it's dark and ominous. Like it's got those horror movie synths in the background and like that stabby synth part over the top. It's just so different from the singles on the album, which were all like party songs. You know what I mean? Like there's nothing fun about this song and I love it.
Yeah, I agree with that. And it's also worth mentioning that like Dr. Dre, there's some sort of connection between Dr. Dre and Reznor that I've never really dug into, but you know, Dre has he produced a track on The Fragile, which is like one of I think it's Nine Inch Nails' best album. It's not my favorite, but I think it's the overall best, right?
I can get behind that.
Like, my favorite is Downward Spiral. But I think The Fragile is a bigger piece of work and more respectable in that sense. It's a more... Fuck. How do I put it? It's
cohesive?
Just...
Like it's more not cohesive.
Well, I think Downward Spiral might even be more cohesive. It's just a bigger meal and it's a great fucking meal. You know, The Fragile is like a 5-star fucking Pink Floyd Dark Side of the Moon fucking album to me, right? And he produced a track on that on The Fragile called Even Deeper. It's the 8th track on The Fragile. Yeah. And also they work together on Beats, you know, the headphone thing or whatever. I feel like these two guys are probably friendly somehow. But it's a really interesting mix of these two dudes coming together. So I'm not surprised to see Dre showing up on this album.
And you see, I forgot about their connections completely. So that actually is going to change part of my notes in a later song. But I knew that there had to be some sort of like the mutual respect between Reznor and Dre.
You know what I mean?
But I forgot that they'd actually worked together.
I would bet that, you know, Dre has also been ahead of the curve on technology.
Oh, for sure.
You know, which is a thing that Reznor's been like, man, he's been at that for fucking years. He was at it before Radiohead was at it.
Yeah.
In terms of like, you know, releasing albums without a label or fucking, you know, free releasing albums. I imagine those two guys respect the shit out of each other, despite the fact that they're both producing like wildly different kinds of music. I think Dre probably likes Reznor's beats, honestly.
Yeah. Yeah. I absolutely could see that. There's a lot. I mean, I just like the idea of the two of them hanging out.
Can you imagine hanging out with Dre and Uncle T? Like, that would be the wildest shit. Like, I wouldn't, I would blend into the fucking wallpaper at that point.
Well, especially like circa 1994. You know what I mean? They were both very different people then, too.
Right. That's very true. And in fact, you know, wilder people. Because Dre did some fucked up shit back in the day. You know, a problematic dude. But also, this is like the pinnacle of when Reznor was the most out of control on drugs.
Yeah.
And
like angry and.
Yeah. Well, angry and fucking, you know, falling apart and all of that shit. Like, I, you know, I would. There's no amount of, how do I say this? No amount of money I wouldn't pay to listen to an extended conversation between Dr. Dre and Trent Reznor circa 1993. You know, that's got to be an interesting fucking conversation. You know, I would love that.
that would be, I want to hear it now. I want to hear how it goes. Yeah, well. Maybe there will be some sort of like documentary that comes out someday where like
probably not, them... but
no, yeah, probably
I
probably
would watch this shit out of it.
All right. So up next, we've got Juliette Lewis. We got two more of these. Like, it's kind of the back bit is very heavy on these. So we've got Juliette Lewis is Born Bad, which is just an excerpt from the movie. It's her singing in the cell. Mm-hmm. And then it leads to Sergio Cervetti's Fall of the Rebel Angels, which is another score piece of dialogue over top. Mm-hmm. Both of those are fine. I understand why they're here. But that leads us to Large Fork Boy, which is from their album The Last Temptation of Reed. So Large is Jello Biafra's side project with Al Jorgensen, Paul Barker, and Jeff Ward of Ministry.
Oh.
And that makes sense now, probably, now that you know that, knowing what the song's like. But it's a much more political song than the title might suggest. You're Fork Boy, you think it's going to be. But I'll tell you what, this song fucking rips, like, right out of the
gate. It's the sequel to Spoon Man from Soundgarden.
You know, Biafra's doing the, like, yelpy sort of vocals. He even hits, like, a hair metal register at some points. But it's really anti-Reagan stuff. The guitar's fucking just like a drill. It's so good.
And Ministry is involved?
Yeah.
I have, here's a quick anecdote. I had heard for years that Nine Inch Nails was originally approached by Steven Spielberg to be like the band on stage during the Flesh Fair sequence in AI. And that,
really?
Yes. And that Nine Inch Nails had turned this down for some reason. And that's why they got Ministry in there. Like, that's the band playing during that segment. Which is, you know, the central fucking thing in that movie. And I asked Trent about that once and was just like, hey, is there any truth to this? Because, you know, I was curious, like, why the fuck wouldn't you accept that job? You know, like, that. Imagine, like, if Spielberg called you up and was like, hey, I need people that kick an immortal amount of ass. And I'd like you to come in. Like, of course you'd fucking come in. You know, and he was like,
right.
Absolutely not true. Never heard anything about this. Love Ministry, but like, no, we were never asked.
Okay.
But that's so like, that's like an urban legend, apparently.
I've never heard that one.
Yeah.
I've never heard that one. There was an urban legend in this movie. There's a song by the Melvins that they play in the bathroom that the rumor was that it was a Kurt Cobain unreleased track for years until people were like, no,
what bathroom?
I don't remember which sequence it's in. It's one of the scenes where they're in a bathroom in this movie.
Yeah, right on. Well, I mean, it's such a pastiche, you know, it could be like 10 seconds and I, you know,
exactly. That's there's 80 musical cues in this movie, 80.
Holy shit.
Yeah. So I do not cover all of them.
The soundtrack only has 27.
And I do not cover all of them when I do the songs not on the soundtrack, because a lot of them are like library pieces, public domain shit.
Right.
So,
right.
But that, okay. So the next one is Batonga in Batongaville, which is again, using like a library piece. Cause it's Night on Bear Mountain, very famous track. I love this one. I do like this one just because, like I've said, the prison riot stuff is probably my favorite in the movie. And just hearing Robert Downey Jr. saying Batonga, Batonga, Batonga over this song cracks me up. But yeah, it's just another one of those pieces. Like, how do you talk about it? Like, it's just an instrumental piece with dialogue over top. But the next one is
I will add one thing to that.
Okay.
If Nightmare on Bear Mountain, it's the same track as Nightmare on Bald Mountain. right?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. For all of your listeners, if you ever get a chance to take shrooms and watch the original Fantasia, fucking do that shit. And that's all I got. Yeah. The Night on Bald Mountain sequence will light you up like a fucking pinball table.
Oh, I mean, everything's good on shrooms, really, at the end of the day. Like, well, you could say put on, well, not everything, but like put yeah, on, I don't, you know, not everything. Yeah. Making a movie like Natural Born Killers, for example, as you said earlier, sure, would sure. probably not be the most
or pleasant. Getting arrested or like, you know, we don't want to do that.
So that leads us to another Nine Inch Nails song, A Warm Place, which is from the Downward Spiral. And again,
the final track one. On the Downward Spiral. As a matter of
yeah fact. And this is the kind of stuff where you hear this and you can see his composer of film scores future ahead of him. Like, it starts off droney, but then it opens up into the spacey dirge, and I love when it hits the part right around a minute and 50 seconds and it becomes like this really pretty synth that leads the rest of the song out. Like, I really love this one.
That's so many fucking Reznor tracks though. Like,
yeah,
if you a while back Nails did an album called Ghosts. Like, I don't know if you're familiar with that, but it's like it's a double album. It's all instrumental. There's no vocals. And then when COVID started up, they released two new volumes, Ghost 3 and 4. And one of them was like geared toward the anxiety and the anger of the whole situation. And the other one was like supposed to calm you down. And those two albums are fucking phenomenal. If you like Reznor's score work with Atticus Ross, you should absolutely like go and, you know, download those. They're I think they're freely available.
Yeah, they were when they came out. I don't know if they still were.
And it's just they work as intended, you know.
Yeah.
Warm Place, I mostly remember as like a track that a buddy of mine that I used to have like wanted played at his funeral.
Okay,
you know, do you have a funeral song, by the way?
I bounce back and forth. Airplane Over the Sea by Neutral Milk Hotel might be the one that I would want. Word.
I'm unfamiliar with the song, but I'll accept it. I want The Hell of It by Paul Williams played at my funeral, which is from Phantom of the Paradise. If you don't,
oh yeah,
yeah.
Good I didn't know nothing, you. Were, I didn't know that song until you said that. Yes.
Yeah. It sounds like a carnival from hell, eulogizing someone that everyone hated. Like I am on record with like three or four different people. Like, listen, I'm gonna die, and I'm gonna die before you. For the love of God, make sure this gets played at my funeral. I have a whole network of spies that will make sure this happens, and it'll be. A fucking hilarious moment, but yeah. Warm Place is a good track. I think Reptile is where they should have ended that album, but you know, I don't know. I'm torn because if you look at that album, it's about a guy losing his fucking mind and eventually killing himself, right?
Yeah.
I think it should have ended a little bit harder, and I think you could maybe go out on Reptile or a couple other tracks from that album. It could have been a Reptile or also the Downward Spiral, which is like the titular track of the album. But like, I don't know. It's, you know, who am I to scoff in the face of Trent Reznor's production abilities? But I think
I'm surprised to hear you second guessing him. Honestly, I'm shocked.
I don't know. I don't know if I can back this up, but I prefer, I mean, I love Hurt, but it's such an, I think Hurt could have arrived earlier in that album and been okay. But I don't know. I'll get yelled at for that, but I'll take it.
Well, that leads us, I guess that leads us to the last of our short tracks, Allah Muhammad Shahryar, which contains excerpts from Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan shows up again. What do you say about this? It's like a minute long, but I do love Nusrat's really chaotic singing in this one. I really like the way this one plays out for that minute, but it's short, you know, and there's not much you can say beyond.
Right.
It's cool for that minute that you're hearing it. But leads us to Leonard Cohen's The Future from the album of the same name as we are earlier. Cohen actually wrote this album. Little background on that album. After he took a year off to help his son Adam recover from a serious car accident in the West Indies that left him in a coma for 4 months. And then as he was writing it, you had the fall of the Berlin Wall and the LA riots. So this reflects that a lot. And this song is like, the album's largely about like this sense of trouble in the world. And this song is about somebody who's in a utopian sort of society where everyone has come together. And the narrator of this song wants it to go back to the way it was before, where there's splits and people have differences. It's cool. Honestly, it sounds like it's like 5 years earlier in regards to production. Like it has a very mid to late 80s sound, but mm-hmm. it works on the album. I like it.
Yeah, I'm familiar with them or that album. So I can't say, you know, I have no deeper insight to add here. But yeah, of course it works.
Okay, and then we close with the Dog Pounds, What Would You Do? This one actually shocked me to learn it was a soundtrack original because, again, me growing up as a rap kid, I was familiar with this from the Murder Was the Case soundtrack, which is also where it appeared. It appeared
on that. You said that thing about Snoop earlier, which I had never heard before, but like they were concerned about Snoop, but they allowed this?
Well, because Snoop's not the main one, they didn't want Snoop on a soundtrack about killers while he was on trial for murder. That was the problem. The Dog Pound didn't have Snoop. It was Daz and Corrupt.
Okay.
Snoop's not a member of the Dog Pound. Well, actually Dre produced this one.
Oh, never mind.
It was half produced by Daz and half produced by Dre, but, and the reason I associate this so much with Murder Was the Case soundtrack is because this was released as a single from that soundtrack, whereas on here it was not.
All right.
But and then again, I actually said in my notes, I'm curious as to how Reznor ended up with this. Like, what's the story here?
Probably because
that's what I'm saying. I forgot about the Drake connection until you said that. I didn't really know about the Drake connection until you said that. So but this song, it's a diss track, it's leveled at Eazy-E, who actually came back with the song of the same title that I think is better in my opinion, his response to this. But I've always loved this song. It kind of splits the difference between what I was talking about earlier, Death Row's like G-Funk party tracks and the stuff like the other Dre song on here, production-wise. Like it's a little darker, but it's still something I could have imagined hearing in like a club in 1994.
Totally.
And Daz and Corrupt have actually done very well since Death Row's Disillusion, which a lot of the like, not to like shit on them here, like, but the B roster rappers, like they were a B roster, you know, like Snoop, Dre, but they were not like the A team, you know what I mean? And a lot of the like Death Row B roster people were left rudderless once Death Row ended, but like, they actually have done pretty well.
I might be way out of line here, but Suge Knight was Death Row, right?
Yeah, Suge Knight was the Death Row.
Oh, he was a rascal, wasn't he?
Yes, he was. Yes, he was. And he fucked a lot of people out of careers.
What is he? Is he?
He's in prison
still. He's alive.
He killed a guy.
Oh, I remember. I remember the trial. But like, is he still alive? Pretended to be
blind and shit. Yeah, he's still alive.
That's crazy. Do you think he's in solitary?
He should be.
I mean, imagine if you're in prison, you're looking for, you know, to go back to our true crime thing earlier. Like Dahmer fucking got taken out by, you know, a wacko that wanted to kill Jeffrey Dahmer, right? So I'm kind of amazed that Suge Knight is still alive. Well, I would think that someone would fucking just for bragging rights.
But the thing is, it goes beyond bragging rights. There is absolutely at least one person in that prison that Suge Knight has fucked over, like personally in real life.
Who?
I would like in one way or another.
Oh, sure. I think Suge Knight has probably fucked me over somehow. You know, like what a fucking prick. But like, yeah, yeah, I would have no trouble believing that, you know, between that or like someone trying to fucking be hard or whatever the, you know, I've been arrested a few times, but I haven't spent time in prison. My understanding is that you would want to take out someone famous to build your legend.
Yeah, build your legacy. Yeah, absolutely. If you're in prison for life, what the fuck? You're the one that killed Suge Knight.
Yeah.
Well, that's on that note, on our fantasies about murdering Suge Knight, that's the soundtrack. that wraps up the soundtrack discussion.
Great album.
Yeah. Quick wrap up here and we're done. So songs in the movie, not on the soundtrack. Like I said, there's 80 pieces of music in this, but it's a lot of public domain library stuff. So as for what fits this criteria, you've got Rage Against the Machine's Bomb track and Take the Power Back, Marilyn Manson's Cyclops, Leonard Cohen's Anthem, Peter Gabriel's The Heat and In Doubt, Cowboy Junkies, If You Were a Woman and I Was the Man, Robert Gordon's The Way I Walk, The Specials' Ghost Town, the Melvin Spread Eagle Beagle, which is the one I was talking about, was rumored to have been a Kurt Cobain song at one time, mm-hmm. and the Shangri-La's Leader of the Pack, and Stephen Bernstein's No Man Part One. Is it on Spotify? This is probably the messiest of these I've done so far because there are like three playlists collecting what's on here, but they're also all like 3.5 hours long. So it's one of those ones where the asshole making them decided to add a ton of extra shit on their own. They're missing songs that are actually on Spotify. So as far as what's actually missing, what you cannot find from this soundtrack on Spotify is Dan Zane's Moon Over Green County, Bob Dylan's You Belong to Me, AOS's History Repeats Itself. And strangely enough, the only version of the Dog Pound's What Would You Do as a live one. So the version from this and Murder Was the Case aren't on there either. But all their albums are, other than Dog Food, their first album. So I'm assuming it's a some sort of Death Row thing that is keeping that album, like Death Row Records and rights and shit right. like that are keeping this off of here. But okay, here's we get to the big questions here. Scott, the movie, would you consider this an essential? Would you say stream it or would you say skip it?
I would say buy it.
Okay, it's an essential then. I own essential, this movie.
Yes. This is the perfect time capsule of the 90s and also a warning of what was to come. You know, yeah. this is absolutely worth owning. It's a yep. challenging movie. You might not like it. You might be put off by it, but like it or not, like this is what it was like, and it's like
yeah.
what it's like now.
Yeah, and I same deal. It's an essential, no question. It's an essential. I think it's even you know taking away even if you take away like the commentary, it's just an entertaining movie, extremely entertaining movie.
Sure,
and you talk and everything else. The soundtrack, would you say the soundtrack is an essential?
Yes.
Would you say, okay.
This is all very easy.
And I would say
so too. Do you have any easy questions for me? Do you have like 1 + 1 equals? Yeah.
Yeah, there actually is one more coming up, but I would call this an essential, but only because of Trent Reznor. It only works because of how he mixed this whole thing together. Someone said on Twitter that this is a bunch of songs that don't really work together, but he made magic by taking everything and tying it together in the way that he did. And I agree with that. I think if you just presented these yeah. songs on their own as a collection of songs,
I agree with it that. Would be but like a I good don't, collection. I don't like that perceived bit of. I don't like that. It feels almost like talking shit about Uncle T, which I will not.
How?
Say. The only way this works is if. Well, maybe you're right. I don't know.
Yeah, say it's a compliment to him. I'm saying the only thing that makes this work is his presence. Did you misunderstand me again?
No, I think that. I don't know. That's a hard one because like no one else could have done this, you know, so to say that it only works because of Trent Reznor is almost like. I don't know.
I think we're in agreement here. Like I'm saying,
maybe
you're saying.
I'm bristling at that, but we've been at this for 4 hours.
I know,
you know, so I'm like, you know, maybe my brain's a little fried. I'm going to let that guy go. I'm gonna let him off with a pass, but you know, something in me is like bristling. But go ahead.
Okay. And then easy question. Do the two go well together? The soundtrack and the movie.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. No question. All right. Top three. What are your top three tracks?
Oh boy. Drums of Go-Go is one of my three for sure.
Is it?
Yeah, I love that. That like okay, jungle no, sort of fucking like bum, bum, yeah. bum, bum. Like it's, you know, if you're working yourself up for a night on the town and you know you're going out and getting blazed or fucked up or whatever you're ingesting that night, listen to Drums of Go-Go, says Scott Wampler. You will be worked up into a lather over that song. Shit List by L7. And Nine Inch Nails, Burn. Those are my picks.
All right, my top three: number one, Nine Inch Nails, Burn; number two, Lard's Fork Boy; and number three, you have me questioning. I'm going to stick with what I have. Dog Pound's What Would You Do? Since it's a true soundtrack original.
Word.
L7 though is one, and that AOS song gets an honorable mention as well.
Yeah,
I like that one. That could have been in there.
That's like four on my list. Probably.
Yeah. There could have been a few. Okay, so further watching, further listening. So I said earlier, there are movies that I kind of hold in with this one where it's like movies that people took the wrong way and then ran with it. And they're not, I'm not even saying these are all great movies. They're varying degrees of quality, but they're ones that were misunderstood by certain audiences who kind of ran with these like narratives that that they fit to their own, what they wanted to think it was about. So the three that I have picked are Fight Club, Falling Down, and American History X. Those are three movies that throughout time people have been like, American History X really surprises me, but there are so many people that think American History X is like pro skinhead, I guess. even though that feels
media
like
media literacy. Very... What did I say?
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
Man Bites Down is another one that I would add, at least thematically, because it's, you know, people following around a killer with a camera. And then as far as further listening, this actually got me to go back and listen to the Dog Food album, the first Dog Pound album, which holds up pretty well. And the first three L7 albums still wail like really hard.
Yeah.
So like, that's my suggestions.
Right. On.
Okay. Scott, your turn. You've been here for a while. Let everyone know what you are up to, where they can find you. The floor is yours.
You can find me on Twitter at Scott Wampler, RIP. That's all one word. You know, no spaces and what have you. I'm also the host of the KingCast on the Fangoria Podcast Network that you can find it at KingCast19 on Twitter. We have a Patreon. We have hundreds of episodes for you to catch up on if you're a horror fan or a Stephen King fan or whatever. And I think that's it.
Okay. And I'll put all that in the show description. I have been on the KingCast a couple of times.
That is true. That is true.
Never get to do fun things like this, but I've been on to do Dreamcatcher and Sharks of the Corn. So,
yeah, well, at least Dreamcatcher was like, you know, only two and a half hours long.
Thank you for choosing this one. Thanks for doing this for way past your normal time for doing a podcast.
Of course. I'm always happy to do it. This is a great show. There's so much to fucking chew on with every one of these things, which, you know, I'm not bored. You know, I've done podcasts that went on for fucking too long that, I got bored as shit, 40 minutes in, I can talk about this movie or the soundtrack or anything involved with it till I'm blue in the face. And I thank you for having me back.
No, I'm always glad to have you on. And we'll have to do it when Andy's back to being healthy. We really do have to get an episode where all three of us get together and pick just something at random at this point.
Yeah, that bitch. Maybe like like a movie about cops being shot. You know, if we can get on that would be cool.
Andy, I know Andy wants to do Vanilla Sky. That was his other choice.
Oh, I love Vanilla Sky.
Okay, yeah, well, maybe we'll plan that one. If he doesn't mind having you on that with him. No.
He doesn't get a choice. Yeah. Andy didn't show up today. He's done. He's done.
That's true. Son. That's true. That's true. That's true. Hopefully he's doing well right now as we're talking shit about him. I've heard from him in 2 days. Okay. No, Scott, as always, I appreciate you coming on. And yeah, we'll definitely have to do something like this again sometime. So
absolutely. Anytime.
And everyone, please check out the KingCast. I will put that in the show description. And everyone listening at home, thank you so much. And I hope that all of you have a tremendous weekend.
Ain't no use running. Ain't nowhere to hide. The beast is coming and he's got you in his sights. He ain't gonna miss you and he ain't gonna mess around. If you're a movie with original songs, the soundtrack are gonna track you down.